dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World on another hot day here in Las Vegas. Where in a minute, I will be talking to one of the coolest people I've ever talked to. There are, for me, few things more pleasurable than learning something new from somebody a month ago, I'm ashamed to say, I had never heard of. In 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War, I had a radical nun on my morning show in Los Angeles on ABC TV. Her name was Sister Carita. Sister Carita had written a small book called To Believe in God. In fairy tales, I am not a believer, but in great writing, I am. So next to a dozen quotes from Mark Twain or Wiley Willie Shakespeare, my next favorite quote is from Sister Carita's book. She said, quote, "To believe in God is to have the deep abiding faith that somewhere, somehow, there is someone who is not stupid," unquote. Well, my guest is that someone. As you know, I've been working with a band of guerrilla truth tellers and putting together part two of the Garrison tapes called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, as told again by Jim Garrison from tapes I have yet to make public. A month ago, I got an urgent call from Myra Bronstein. Myra is a computer whiz in Carolina. She's also a JFK expert who is making an absolute major contribution to this film. And now, with this suggestion, she's making another one. She told me about this book called Conspiracy Theory in America and the author. And she said we had to include his work in the film. Since then, I've gotten his book and spent hours this past week spellbound and applauding his lectures on YouTube. Last night, I spent another hour and a half watching, quote, "State Crimes Against Democracy, Moving Beyond Conspiracy Theory," unquote. And you all know, if you're a serious researcher into the Kennedy killing, you will be denigrated by someone calling you a conspiracy theorist. And it was all planned to do that, to make you feel lousy. Our guests will tell you how and why and when it all happened and all started. He's a professor at Florida State University in Tallahassee, author of over a dozen books, including The Battle for Florida about the stolen 2000 election, and the book I have in my hand as I speak, soon to be in our documentary, Conspiracy Theory in America. Amazingly, he's been interviewed by almost every major mainstream anchor, in spite of the fact he exposes their complicity in hiding the truth about the murder of John Kennedy. A joy to welcome Professor Lance DeHaven Smith. Professor, thank you so much for being here. It is a delight to talk to you and to meet you and look at you and read your stuff. Thank you.
You're welcome. I feel the same way about you, John. You've done work on the Kennedy assassination that I'm familiar with, and you've been a longtime advocate of beliefs that are, I think, straightforward, but are criticized and people make fun of them. And that's,
well, Professor, do you mind if I call you Lance, the weapon used by Don Quixote? I might add. So perfect. Do you mind if I call you Lance? And could you tell us a little bit about your background, where you were born, your family, your siblings, your early aspirations, how you ended up at Florida State University or in Tallahassee, and how on earth you got involved in this subject.
Well, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and I have a twin sister. My parents were just middle class. And I grew up like a lot of people. I was loyal, uncritical of my government. I was in the military service during the Vietnam War, and I did not leave the country or anything. I came back from that military experience confused about things. I didn't understand what had happened to our government. I was discharged in October of 1972. And that was right before the Nixon stole the election in 72 with the Watergate crimes, which unfortunately are called the Watergate break-in, but were much more extensive than that. But I watched the Watergate hearings for, you know, months, and I began to doubt my government, but I still looked at it like it was a one-time thing, that it was just Nixon. And that didn't change. I became a professor, again, looking at American government, and I became an expert on Florida government, and was at Florida State University in Tallahassee when the 2000 election breakdown occurred. And I knew the law, and I watched as high crimes were committed. I mean, crimes at the very highest level of Florida government, including the governor, the secretary of state, and others. And I thought it would be investigated afterwards. I just thought, well, things were moving so fast, and it was complicated and everything. And most people didn't understand the law. But then nothing happened. I began wondering what was going on. But then the thing that really, really made, you know, change my entire viewpoint was the 2004 election, which was basically a repeat of the 2000 stolen election. And this time it was in Ohio rather than Florida, but it was the same thing. You had suspicious anomalies in the voting returns. There were actually some people arrested in Ohio for falsifying ballots, in Florida and Ohio both, there's very good indications that votes were shifted.
Lance, for me, you know, the most disappointing thing about that election is, again, it popped up with John Kerry, it popped up with Ron Paul, it popped up with Bernie Sanders, was that John Kerry said that he had hired a team of 20 lawyers and that he was going to challenge the outcome in Ohio and challenge the outcome in Florida, and a week later called it off. It was like Ron Paul saying, you know, we got to audit the Fed, and he had such an enormous backing. I mean, he could draw thousands of people, as could Bernie Sanders. Look at the people that he had, and all of a sudden they back out and they go crawl back into the system that they've been attacking.
There's a reason for that, and that is that the elite, the political elite, is a class. It's a unified class that. And they feel like if anybody questions the legitimacy of the government in a fundamental way, that it could bring down the entire system. Let me give you an example. This we know, Lyndon Johnson had discovered that Richard Nixon in 1968 was urging the South Vietnamese government from withdrawing from the peace talks. He sent word to them that he could get them a better deal. And they did withdraw from the peace talks, and it, you know, sabotaged what could have been the end of the war. And
there's an LBJ phone call.
You can hear it online. And he says in the phone call, he's talking to Everett Dirksen, a Republican senator. And he says, you know, you've got to tell Nixon to stop this. It's outrageous. It's treason. But I'm not going to say anything because I'm afraid the American people would never trust their government again. Now, here's a guy.
Well, the same thing also happened with Ronald Reagan and the hostages in Iran, which cost Carter the election.
Yes, the October surprise. And, you know, that's been very well studied. But people don't, you know, the elite will not break ranks. Even, I'll give you one more example. George Wallace was shot in 1972. It looked like he could take seven states and deprive Richard Nixon of the victory in 72, but he was, you know, shot down in the streets. Well, he thought it was Nixon. He went to the FBI and he said, you know, how could this guy have gotten a gun and followed me? Who paid for his hotel expenses? This guy's just a loser. It couldn't have been, you know, it had to be Nixon. And, but he didn't ever say it publicly. You know, he, at the risk of his own life, he was silent. And even the Kennedy family, the only person that said anything in all these years is Robert Kennedy Jr. A couple of years ago came out and said, you know, he thought it was a plot of the government and so on.
Well, I guess it's sort of understandable why he is so silent. And I had a very unfortunate incident with him 2 years ago when I had him booked for $25,000 to appear at UNLV with George Knapp, a really outstanding newsman and reporter who received the Ed Murrow Award a couple of years ago. And George Knapp was going to interview him. They were going to run the Garrison Tapes movie and take questions afterwards. And Robert Jr. backed out at the last moment. So I have no fond memories of him, but I can sort of understand it, because there's no question that they killed his uncle. There's no question they killed his father. And I wouldn't be surprised if it happened to John as well in the airplane crash.
Yeah.
Now, get back to Nixon for just a minute. In listening to you last night, I was interested to find out why you thought those burglars were going into Watergate. Repeat it, because I have a little story as an aside that I wish to tell you. So tell the folks why you think they went back into the Watergate to bug.
And remember that they went back in.
Yes.
They had already tapped the phones of the head of the party and his administrative assistant, and one of the wiretaps quit working, so they went back in 2 weeks later, and that's when they were apprehended. It's been a big question. Why would they have done that? Why? What were they looking for?
Well, can I tell you this little story?
Yeah.
Okay. I was hosting a show, AM Chicago. It was before they hired Oprah Winfrey, and they hired Charlie Rose after they me. I was just a fill-in for 2 weeks, and Charlie bombed and went someplace else, and they brought in Oprah. So that's a little tidbit. But anyway, my guest was one of Nixon's major speechwriters, whose name sort of is gone right now. But in two sentences, and I read every author's book before I talk to them, not to show that I am smart. It's just that I want the author himself or herself to answer the questions. Anyway, there were two sentences in his book, and he says the break-in was really about getting information about the hit on Castro. And he only mentioned it passingly, because the truth was McGovern was no threat to Richard Nixon at all. So why would they bug it? They didn't need information. But when I interviewed him, he spent the next half hour explaining that Robert Mayhew and the CIA and elements of the mafia, John Rosselli and Sam Giancana, met at the Desert Inn in Las Vegas with Larry O'Brien. And then Larry O'Brien, this was the plot to kill Castro, which many feel backfired and resulted in the murder of John Kennedy, because Kennedy did not support the invasion of Cuba and the Bay of Pigs. Anyway, Larry O'Brien, he says, becomes head of the Democratic Party, and his office is at the Watergate Hotel. And what Nixon wanted is what Haldeman referred to in his book, as Nixon would always say, that Cuban thing, or that big pig thing. And he said it was to see if there were documents that O'Brien had about the meeting about the hit on Castro.
And the other thing about the Castro thing was when Haldeman referred to that, he also said that included the Kennedy thing.
That's exactly right.
So he, you know, there's so much buried with Nixon. You know, when Nixon was impeached and resigned, they pardoned him not for one particular crime, but for any crime he may have committed.
I was stunned when I heard him say that last night, because I thought I knew he'd been pardoned. I didn't know he'd been pardoned for stuff that they had not uncovered. So how, Lance, why pick such an interesting but obscure two words to investigate the source of, and that is conspiracy theory? Now, in the documentary that we're doing, you know, it's astonishing. There are literally hundreds of thousands of people out there on the internet who come across what it is you're doing, and a fellow found out what it is we were doing, contacted Myra Bronstein and sent her a memo that was recently released as a result of Oliver Stone's film. Congress had to, they had to release some of these documents. Yeah. They did not mean to release this one, but it's a 1967 CIA memo that says they are urged to help Clay Shaw in New Orleans because they are afraid, quote, that Jim Garrison is going to get a conviction of Clay Shaw. Now, why would they want to help Clay Shaw unless they were protecting themselves? And out of that came this whole thing about conspiracy theory. How on earth, what prompted you to do that obscure but brilliant research?
Well, after I saw the 2004 election, I sat down and wrote a list. I had never done this, and most people wouldn't, but I wrote a list of all the suspicious things: the Kennedy assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, the George Wallace attempt on his life, the attempt on Reagan, the Watergate break-in, burglary it's called, the October surprise in the 1980 election, and so on. And I wrote this list, and it suddenly dawned on me that what we have is a serial criminal in America that is committing a series of crimes that are interrelated. And it's pretty obvious once you think about it. But once you write the list, it's very obvious. And what's surprising to me is, when we normally look at crimes, we look for patterns. And if a wealthy woman marries a poor man and she dies of a fall in the shower and he gets all her money, and then he marries another woman who has money and dies of a, you know, another home accident. I mean, the first thing we do is indict him, you know. We'd be digging up the bodies and everything. And yet when we see these things, the high crimes – I mean, think about it. John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy were brothers. They were both campaigning for president. But nobody ever says the Kennedy assassinations, the plural. It's always the Kennedy assassination and the assassination of Robert Kennedy. They don't connect them.
They want them connected, because if they were connected, people would be suspicious.
It's obvious. That's what is really motivated my research. It's not just discovering these patterns, but trying to understand how we could not see them as an electorate. I mean, think about it. Kennedy gets assassinated. Oswald is apprehended in 90 minutes. He's brought in for questioning. They question him for 2 days. Nobody takes notes. Nobody records it. He is killed in police headquarters in police custody on live television. And you're telling me we don't think there's something strange about that that ought to be thoroughly investigated? But no.
You would think the logical question to Ruby would be, by one of the commissioners, and you remember he begged Earl Warren, Gerald Ford, to take him to Washington where he could tell the truth. And Jim Garrison sardonically said, well, Earl and Gerald didn't take him to lunch that day, okay? And he said that the people will never find out the truth. But the obvious question would be, Jack, who ordered you to shoot Oswald? And, you know, it's so simple. Jim Garrison showed me how he tracked down a guy named Lawrence V. Myers from looking into phone records of David Ferry and Jack Ruby and Lawrence V. Myers' mistress in Chicago. And then Garrison tracks Lawrence V. Myers to the Cabana Motel, and where they meet, he meets with Ruby for 2 days and then leaves after Ruby kills Oswald. Those questions are never asked. And Jim Garrison's solving of that crime is denigrated. Even when he died, they called him a conspiracy theorist. Even when Mark Lane recently died, they called him a conspiracy theorist.
You know what gets me? This is kind of a tangent, but Vincent Bugliosi wrote a book, you know, a massive thing to try to salvage the official account of Kennedy assassination. I would urge readers to look at that book, because he's got a footnote in there that he says he admits that Kennedy's head shot back, you know, pushed back after the bullet hit him in the front, which meant that it had to come from the front and it wasn't, you know, a lone gunman or anything like that. Bugliosi admits this, but he says, well, it could have been a reaction to a second bullet. But that automatically means there were multiple shooters. So what does Bugliosi say when he's trying to justify the official account? He says, well, I'm a prosecutor. I'm just making the case for Oswald being the killer. And he's willing to twist the truth. He's willing to drop stuff out. It's the most disappointing book, because he's otherwise been a very credible guy. But
also look what happened to Bill O'Reilly. I remember Inside Edition back in the 70s, and almost every other story, there was Bill O'Reilly out there saying, you know, Oswald maybe didn't do it, or maybe it was Umbrella Man, or maybe it was Roscoe White's father. I mean, he had all these kinds of stories, and all of a sudden he ends up at Fox Television. And God Almighty writes this horrifying book, worse than Case, called Killing Kennedy. I mean, it's beyond belief.
Yep, it's a class. It's a political class, and they take care of each other, and they
one of the stories you told, repeat to the audience. I just loved it. It was such an inside story, and it reeked of such truth. It was the story that you told on stage about Ronald Reagan, I think, being forced to accept George Bush as his running mate. Now, here comes this guy from the CIA, and they had the poster in it. Tell us that story.
Well,
why Bush ended up being the running mate.
Well, Bush ended up being the running mate because Reagan was pressured into taking him, and there were a number of people, including the Rockefellers, who did that. But I lost my train of thought.
Well, the poster that they
used. Oh, yeah. There were posters all in the CIA that had Reagan Bush on them, but they would X out Reagan. You know, it's like so they were all working for Bush. Remember what had happened in 1976 when Carter got elected, this was kind of a fluke, and he came in and fired a bunch of people at the CIA. He really cleaned house. They were out to get him. We just have a very corrupt criminal elite in our government.
Well, you had a number.
And it's been running our country since.
You had a few people in the audience asking you just wonderful questions, and it's invigorating to me to know that there's so many people out there like your audience and like yourself who have impassioned real knowledge about this. And two or three of the people said, well, how do we fix it? And you brought up I had Chris Hedges on here about 3 or 4 months ago. I love Chris Hedges' stuff. And I must tell you, I also have almost every foreign policy book written by Noam Chomsky. Tell me what you told your audience about Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges that sort of broke my heart.
Well, it does break your heart because they will step right up to the edge. But when it comes to talking about high criminality in American government, they don't. They want to talk about structural problems, you know, put it in Chomsky's terms, that, you know, there's a media that's controlled by the big business and they all have a stake in legitimating the system. So they come out with this uniform line that indoctrinates everybody. And so we accept this elite war, belligerent war empire. But the reality is they won't talk about the crimes. And that's our only hook into this crowd. And we need to start prosecuting these sons of guns. And
well, in the case of Chomsky and Hedges, for example. Now, Hedges is, to me, personally, a little more appealing than Chomsky because Hedges seems to have a real simpatico about him and his presentation. He's very low-key, and it's pleasant to listen to him. He is extremely popular. It wouldn't take much for him to utter two sentences about what it is that you were saying, that these people murdered John Kennedy, aside from all the other things that they're doing, and we should look into it. And if you go on YouTube, you can see Chomsky. He's in front of 1,000 people, and somebody invariably will stand up and say, well, what about the you're a foreign policy expert. The biggest foreign policy disaster is Vietnam because they murdered Kennedy. And he becomes tongue-tied, and he poos-poos. He literally says, it makes no difference, or it's not important. I've seen him do that. And then when he tries to answer a real question, this linguist becomes tongue-tied and can't speak English.
Exactly. And it's, I think they're worried about being discredited. I think they may worry about physical safety because, you know, they have a large following and they could say things that could attract attention. But, ultimately, you know, my own view is they just don't have the guts to say it because they're not stupid. And anybody with any sense that looks at the history of American government in the last 60 years can see that it is littered with high crimes. And even if you don't see them now, you know, they come out later. We found the 1980 October surprise and the importation of the CIA importing cocaine into the United States in the 1980s. Well, that came out. It was a one-day story in the news.
It just fades. It's a one-day story because very, very few people know about Project Mockingbird and the fact that it has infiltrated the media at the highest levels ever since the 1950s. There is not one major newspaper that wasn't infested. There wasn't one major television network that wasn't infested, and they admit to it.
And so, they still are. I think that we should not underestimate the extent to which the CIA and other intelligence agencies are actively involved and successfully involved in constructing our history and beliefs about history and our political system. You know, I found that the conspiracy theory concept came from the CIA. It was planted in the media. You know, I said in my book that it has to be credited as one of the most successful propaganda initiatives of all time. Well, that's not the only thing these guys have done. Obviously, if they can do that, they're doing all kinds of things. Another example that I pointed to was 9/11, the very term 9/11. Where did that come from? Because we don't normally name these kinds of tragedies after the date. You know, the Oklahoma City bombing, the Kennedy assassination. We name the people who were harmed, the tactics that were used, the targets that were covered. We don't say, you know, 11/22 to label the Kennedy assassination. So why don't we do 9/11? Well, that shows up the day after the election. It's in an article in the New York Times by a reporter who had been the CIA, been the station chief for the New York Times in Soviet Union when it was collapsing, and obviously would have had a lot of CIA contacts. And he comes out and he says 9/11, an aptly labeled emergency call. Now, see what they've done? They've named this thing as a date, and it's a date that rings with the emergency number 911.
Exactly. It does that, and then it also dehumanizes because you're looking at a number and not people. Lance, we're going to take a brief break right now. We're going to have Joe Satilli join us, who is by far one of the best journalists in the country. He has a fabulous daily newsletter, really objective, really informing, called News Vandal. You'll be delighted to meet him. We'll be right back after this break with Lance DeHaven Smith and Joe Satilli.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
This is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World with Lance DeHaven Smith. Just a fabulous, fabulous book called Conspiracy Theory in America. And we're joined now by Joe Satilli, my right-hand man, who is making an enormous, enormous contribution also to part two of the Garrison Takes called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Joe, I know you have a couple of really interesting things in your news vandal today, but maybe one of them might relate to what it is that we're talking to Lance about, and what might relate to the documentary that you're involved in, and that is watching the American media disintegrate before our eyes. Would you wish to expand on that?
Well, sure. And actually, you know, good to be with you, Professor DeHaven Smith.
Thank you.
One of the questions I had for you relates to what's going on in the news. Last week, I wrote a piece about Trump, and Trump is a font of radical often bizarre conspiracy theories. And I wondered if you've ever come to the conclusion or what you think about the idea of some conspiracy theories are actually planted as red herrings, and there is a machinery now in place that is pumping out conspiracy theories, one, to muddy the water for the conspiracy theories that are actual criminal conspiracies and thus taint them. But on another level, isn't there a little bit of a power play in being able to, let's say, for example, you want to convince people that there's a powerful cabal of Illuminati with such great control over the world's events that actually there's almost nothing that you can do in the face of their power, that these kinds of conspiracy theories actually become dual-use conspiracy theories to both control the narratives on the conspiracies that are real, the criminal conspiracies, and then also to demoralize people to accept their fate?
Absolutely. I'm confident that conspiracy theories, ludicrous conspiracy theories, are being planted as disinformation. It's a common tactic. You know, and there's a language for this, you know, the disinformation and the false flag, and the intelligence people talk in that language. They're used to manipulating things in very sophisticated ways. What I keep coming back to is I stress to people, don't forget the law. Because the reality is the government agencies and the people in the government have sworn an oath to protect the Constitution. And these people are criminals. They are criminals when they defy the Constitution, when they undermine it, when they discourage rational thought about what is going on. And we have tools to get at them. I mean, if we use the normal things that we do when some schmuck has robbed a bank, you know, we interview everybody he was with. We promise deals to people who are lower level. If they'll implicate the upper level guys, we'll let you off the hook. They subpoena everything. They go through the records.
But Lance, let me inject here something really, really important. Talking about the law, Jim Garrison says very forcefully that his strongest case against Clay Shaw was the perjury case, not necessarily the conspiracy case, because he would have a hard time proving that Shaw was CIA because the Justice Department refused to serve subpoenas on any CIA. Okay, they literally tore them up. Okay, now he had dozens and dozens of witnesses that could verify that Clay Shaw knew Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry, and he got a very quick conviction for perjury from the jury. So now here you have a district attorney who is very influential, very powerful in his city, in his state. He is following the law. Now he tells me on camera, he says, now we've got him nailed. Because he is going to name names. And guess what? The federal government steps in and prevents his prosecution for perjury. Now, you're telling me we got to follow the law, but the government is the law.
That's the problem. And that's what we've got to do, is separate out a law enforcement agency that is distinct from the government in general and that is empowered with subpoena powers. And the one thing we can try to rely on is professionalism, people that are socialized.
Where would that come from? You know, Chris Hedges, when he was on our show and talking about the fear that we would eventually invade Iran, which, you know, is absolute and total nonsense, and another one of those frauds, he said all we have left is civil disobedience. Now, a grand jury can be absolutely terrific, but who's going to put together a grand jury if maybe they're afraid of getting shot?
Well, that's true. I mean, the first thing, though, that we have to do is start talking about it, like you were doing. We have to start saying, our government's corrupt. We've got to police it. These people are committing crimes. We see it. It's obvious once you start looking at it. And we've got to attack it with the tools that we have, which is the law and police detection. We need to develop forensics for high crimes. I have this idea. You know, they have this voice stress analysis that you can do.
Yes.
And we ought to run every speech that the politicians make through a voice stress analysis and show it on TV with the, you know, the blips, you know, liar.
You know, I guess the sad thing, and Joe, I want you to join in on this in a second. The really sad thing is people are social creatures like sheep, quite honestly. And the government is smart enough to find out who the shepherds are. They're the John Kennedys and the Robert Kennedys and the John Lennons. And they dispose of them. And you have all these assassination, supposedly research sites, meeting annually in Dallas or New Orleans or Pittsburgh when they should be meeting November 26th in front of the Justice Department where it is an open case. But who is going to go there? I mean, the only two people in America, I think, who could be shepherds in this would be Oliver Stone because of his film and Dr. Cyril Wecht. Who from the very beginning said it was a coup. He said in 1967, it's a coup. Yeah. But they don't do it, and I don't blame them. You know, they're probably afraid of their lives. And I guess Oliver figures, well, I'm better off making movies like JFK and Snowden. So there you have it. There's nobody to lead us there.
Well, and that dovetails with my next question for Professor DeHaven Smith. To what extent do you think Trump is in an odd way or an organic culmination of 40 plus years of these unsolved conspiracies metastasizing in the public mind?
Absolutely.
Great question.
I think America is like the Soviet Union when everybody quit believing the government there. It's now, you know, people believe – they're not idiots. Americans generally question the Kennedy assassination, the John Kennedy assassination. They generally
90% of Americans don't believe Oswald even did it.
Right. So there's this very pervasive cynicism out there, but there's never anybody that leads them. Nobody. Remember, 3 or 4 years ago, Kerry said something publicly about not believing that the Warren Commission got everything. And this was national news. I mean, and boy, Kerry shut up fast. So there's nobody in the elites that will broach it. And that's what's happened with Trump. You know, whatever you can say about it, how ludicrous some of his ideas are, the fact of the matter is he has been willing to voice them. And he's one of the few top leaders, top people in the country that's ever said this stuff out loud.
Well, he brought out that stuff about Cruz's father.
Well, and I mean, this is the danger, is that and there is a debate. And there is a debate among mainstream sources. You've had Marcy Kaptur, a member of Congress from Ohio, question whether – she's a Democrat. Question whether Trump was in the tank for Clinton, sort of half jokingly. But there are a lot of people on the Republican side who wonder if there was this phone call about this phone call that happened a few weeks before Trump decided to run between Bill and Trump, and whether he was goaded in, and whether he's actually, in a sense, a suicide bomber who's run into the middle of the Republican Party and blowing it up. Right. So there are, you know, in a sense, we live in a world – I love your analogy about the end of the Soviet Union, because we live in a world where there are so many conspiracies folded on top of one another that people kind of don't know which way is up. And so the question is whether Trump is organically voicing these concerns or whether he's unwittingly a stooge, not of Putin, but of the disinformation specialist, because it has – you know, Roger Stone has been intimately involved – in Donald Trump's campaign. And I think Roger Stone is somebody about whom you could say you could probably trust him as far as you could throw him.
Right. You know, I agree. I think the reality is we don't know what's going on.
Right.
Our government is so secret, and so it's multiple layers, it's multiple agencies. You know, William Pepper was on John's show a couple of days ago, and he talked about the intelligence, this battalion 202 that was involved from the Pentagon in the assassination of Martin Luther King. I mean, there's just, you know, all these things going on. Who knows? But until we can start prosecuting people and subpoenaing them and nailing down what is going on, we're at the mercy of this very our very thoughts are under the control of these people. I mean, think about conspiracy theory.
Lance and Joe, your thoughts really on, you know, there were 13 million people who voted for Bernie Sanders. And these were the people that have been heir to all the frustrations. They know the truth of the corruption of the government. And they're hoping that Bernie is going to hit up a third party. And he caves in and supports Hillary Clinton. What happens to the despair and disappointment that these people feel? Now, some of them may rechannel to Jill Stein or over to Gary.
Well, I think the younger generation, the millennials, were disillusioned by Barack Obama to begin with.
True.
I mean, here was hope and change, and the first thing he does is get in and sell the healthcare system to the insurance companies. I mean, he was so disappointing. It's amazing that Bernie Sanders had traction with that group. It's amazing that they've still got heart. But how much of this can they take?
What you have here, too, is an interesting dynamic in which we're all old enough to where the Kennedy assassination matters, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy matters, the assassination of Martin Luther King. For me, the seminal event of my life as I was coming of age was Iran-Contra. We still do not have the full official – the official story does not come close to telling the full story of Iran-Contra, which eventually leads to Gary Webb's unfortunate suicide,
yes,
if that's what you believe, because it's all interconnected. And Robert Perry has unpacked the October surprise, because the Iran-Contra was actually built on trying to undermine Jimmy Carter's efforts to release the hostages. Had he released the hostages, which he had negotiated, he would have won that
election.
He would
have won.
Right. So – for young people, and I happen to have a young millennial who just got back from a tour in the Pacific on the Navy, and we were talking about Bernie Sanders last night. And, you know, it's interesting for them, their seminal event is not just 9/11, but it's the 2008 crash. And that 2008 crash is also one of the grand criminal conspiracies of American history. But it's never thought of as a criminal conspiracy, and it certainly hasn't been prosecuted as a criminal conspiracy. And I think one of the reasons why there is a disillusionment, or was a disillusionment with Obama, is that Eric Holder, who has been and going through the revolving door between Wall Street law firms and government for 25 years, did nothing to prosecute the criminals involved in one of the great rip-offs in human history.
Yeah, they bailed out the banks and not the homeowners.
And not the homeowners. And by the way, I remember savings and loan scandal. Do you know some like 400 people actually went to jail?
Yeah.
For the savings and loan scandal. This did not happen here. And so Occupy Wall Street, which cropped up in response to all of this, was derided as leaderless and feckless and not really having any kind of agenda. But that's what Bernie Sanders' campaign was. It was the personification of Occupy Wall Street. Alas, he seems to have sold it out to the Democratic Party when he really did have an opportunity to hand it off into a broader movement, maybe not Jill Stein, but at least to keep it separate from the Democratic Party and being co-opted by the people who actually paved the way for what happened in 2008, and that would be the Clintons.
Well, Joe, what is so astounding? You talk about your millennial coming home, and that's wonderful that he's home. So I'm really pleased for you for that. But look at all the young people. They were anywhere from 21 to 25,
yeah,
millions of them, following a guy in his 70s.
Yep.
Little guy from Vermont, you know, it's amazing.
Well, here, I can ask you both of you this, because this is my sense of it, is that what you had, oddly enough, playing out in the campaign was the idealism of the 60s versus the sellout of the 60s. Because if nobody embodies the idealism of the 60s better than the Bernie Sanders, and nobody embodies the sellout of the baby boomers more than the Clintons. They sold out the ideals of the 60s on their way to their 100 million plus Clinton Foundation and massive wealth and selling out all of the principles of the Democratic Party in the 1990s. And here was the idealism of the 60s still alive, and young people were making a choice.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I hadn't thought about that, about the 60s and the comparison. But I would say that the Occupy Wall Street, as much as people think it didn't do much, it introduced the idea of the 1%.
Yes, yes.
And this is like a concept. You know, this is just as sophisticated as conspiracy theory as a concept, or the other memes that the government foist on us. This is a counter
incredible messaging.
And it has penetrated the entire electorate. And it's what the reason you could have Bernie Sanders is people saying, well, yeah, the damn country's run by the 1% for the 1%.
So, Professor David Smith, I'll ask you one final question and then turn it over to John. You know, we're talking about the 60s still, which I think is interesting. And I wonder, do you believe that there is there one seminal event, one keystone in the arch that's holding up the whole corrupt system? And is that keystone the one thing that should be solved and can be solved and must be solved for everything to break free? Is it the Kennedy assassination, the original Kennedy assassination, not the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, but John?
I think that would go a long way. This is going to sound ludicrous, but I think the government is like a parent who doesn't want their child to know that the Santa Claus is not real, because if they said Santa Claus isn't real, you know, they say, what's the Easter Bunny? You know, what about the Tooth Fairy? You know, everything unravels.
Well, to me, Lance, the most amazing thing that disappoints me about the American public and the American media is this: that the lie of the John Kennedy assassination is the only lie to which the government has not admitted being responsible for. Everyone now accepts the fact the Gulf of Tonkin was a fraud.
Right, right.
The Vietnam War was a fraud. Everybody accepts it. You can even hear Tom Brokaw say it was a fraud, okay?
Yep.
Okay, now we go to 9-1-1. It is a fraud that the Building 7 came down because it was hit by smoke. They accept it's a fraud. It was never investigated or explained by the committee that supposedly investigated. It was a fraud and a lie that Iraqis were involved with 9-1-1. Everybody admits to that, even the media. The biggest fraud of all and the biggest lie, of course, was George Bush and weapons of mass destruction, and that bitch Condoleezza Rice saying we don't want the smoking gun to be an atom bomb, which led to millions and millions of deaths, okay? It's all a lie. 2008 was a lie, which was never, never, ever prosecuted for. But they all admit it. But they will not admit the lie of the John Kennedy assassination. Because if they admit that lie, it all unravels. George Bush Sr. said in 1967, if they ever found out what we were up to, they'd chase us down the street and hang us.
And that's George the truth.
Bush knows what happened on November 22nd, 1963. And somebody has to get after these people. I don't care if they waterboard them, for crying out loud, to get the truth about this.
And in the Warren Commission report, the magic bullet theory is right there.
They use the word theory to support their theory.
Yeah, yeah.
But they denigrate us by saying we're conspiracy theorists.
That's right.
Anyway,
I know. On that depressing note,
it is absolutely frustrating, and it does feel like we are helpless in the face of this, because it persists, and it persists in contravention to facts and evidence, and facts and evidence that seem to mount every year. Something new will come up, and there's some other way of corroborating. I wonder the extent to which
– Well, one thing I think the CIA has learned something very important. And that is when there's a charismatic leader like John Kennedy or Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy or John Kennedy Jr.
Or John Lennon.
Or John Lennon. You take them out. There's no replacement.
Right.
No. These are rare human beings. They're charismatic and they can mobilize.
But they rose at a time, Lance, when the society would allow them to rise. I mean, you know, John Lennon came out of the Beatles in the 60s. John F. Yeah. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the demonstrations, the civil rights movement, Malcolm X, the same thing. There was an energy in the land. While there was violence and conflict, there was an intellectual energy in the land. It has all gone.
Well, what I'm saying is,
we live in a society now that rewards excellence except in athletes.
What I'm saying is there's a reason for that, and that is that our own government, they basically took out the left in the 60s. I mean, there was not a new generation of charismatic leaders. The closest thing we had was Obama, and, you know, he turned out to be a sellout. So, you know, that's why he survived, I suppose. But,
if my friend Red Fox were alive, he'd call Obama a lawn jockey for Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, I remember the night he got elected. The students all went down to the FSU stadium, and there were like 50,000 of them cheering. People were blowing their horns in the street. It was considered a huge victory for the people. And then to have him squander it the way he did, it's just...
Well, at the end of my conversation with Jim Garrison, it was September 25th, 1980, a couple of things when I asked him why he ever thought he could take on the government. He said, John, I guess as a kid I saw one too many Frank Capra movies, and I guess I made the mistake of thinking I was living in the country I was born in. Now, that's 1980. You know, that's 36-something-odd years ago. We're much worse off than we are now. But I asked him, you know, he believed the Warren Report because he said, John, I was in the Army. I'm a man of authority. How would anybody think they would question their government, let alone think the government would be involved in it? It was only an accidental meeting with Hale Boggs, dissenting member of the Warren Commission, who disappeared. I mean, before he died, he said the Warren Report lied to us.
Right.
I want to thank you all very, very much. Lance, tell folks where they can get a hold of your book. Tell folks where they can watch your videos. And when you're done doing that, Joe, tell us when we can hear you again and how we can support your news vandal. Go ahead, Lance.
My book, Conspiracy Theory in America, is available in paperback. You can get it on Amazon. It's probably the best place to go. I have a number of YouTube presentations that were videotaped there in places where I was speaking in Denver, for example. There's RT Television. I was on an interview there. Just, you know, Google Dehaven-Smith and punch videos, and you should come up with a few.
And okay, Joe, you.
Yeah, just go to newsvandal.com. If there's a Patreon button, you can support me there. When you go to NewsVandal, you'll be able to sign up for the rundown. Tomorrow night I'll be on the Acelli Effect. And, of course, looking forward to being on with you again, John, in a fortnight.
Oh, I just love it, Joe. I'll tell you, couldn't do this without you. And I would say if there's anybody listening who cannot afford the NewsVandal, you just send me an email or pop a message up on my Facebook page and tell me why you want to listen to Joe and why you want to read his NewsVandal, and I will buy you a gift subscription, okay? So thank you all very much, and as Edward R. Murrow used to say before he got fired for telling the truth, thank you so much. Thank you all. Good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. Desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.